Hi there. This is Amy Reitnauer Jacobs, co-founder and executive director of The Bluegrass Situation. BGS started in Los Angeles and has always been proud to call it home. With the recent wildfire devastation in Altadena and the Palisades, so many members of our roots music community have lost everything. With more difficult days ahead, we now focus on rebuilding and continuing to support the artists and creators who make Los Angeles and the surrounding area so special. Please visit thebluegrasssituation.com/LAfires to find ways you can help our musical community when they need us most. Thanks.
Hi and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation. It's Cindy. Hi, I host this podcast. Oh man, we have Carolyn Kendrick on the pod today, and she has spent a year deep diving into Satan. Oh my goodness. This was a crazy interview to prepare for. I think it went well and hope you enjoy it. Before we get into that, let's talk about ways to stay in touch. You can sign up for the Basic Folk newsletter. I think this is the best way to, the more I understand the world and the more I understand technology, email is a great way to stay in touch with a thing that you love. If you love Basic Folk and want to stay in touch and want to know what's going on, you can sign up for our newsletter. Find that link in the show notes or at basicfolk.com. That's where you can sign up. You can also follow us on social media, which I'm becoming more and more wary of as each hour passes. But we are on Facebook, Instagram. Is TikTok still a thing? I'm recording this at the beginning of January, so it is now. But we're on TikTok, if it still exists. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, at Basic Folk Pod. You can follow us there. We are a listener-supported podcast. Some of you have given us contributions, and thank you so much if you have. We wrapped up our fall campaign at the end of 2024, and we're offering Basic Folk beanies featuring our new logo. If you contributed, hopefully you have received said beanie. Love to see a pic of you. You can send it to us in an email or on social media. Would just love to see that. If you want to email us, it's basicfolkpod@gmail.com. Or you can email me, cindy@thebluegrasssituation.com. There you go. Two different ways to email. Okay, so we are a listener-supported podcast. If you'd like to become a supporting listener, you can make a contribution at basicfolk.com/donate. That link is also in the show notes. We are getting on to tax season, and I was looking at our income versus expenses for last year. Whew, razor thin margin. We do get paid in spirit very well for doing this podcast. It is an honor to produce and make this podcast alongside the Bluegrass Situation. We are rich in spirit. And if you'd like to help us pay our bills, you can help us with a contribution at basicfolk.com/donate. Carolyn Kendrick, let's talk about this project. So there's a lot of information that we talk about in this episode. There are other podcasts where Carolyn kind of like explains the research and the interviewing she did in order to dive deep into the devil, but we don't really talk about that research on the podcast today. This album that she put out, Each Machine, it's a record of traditional folk songs. There is an original song that is creepy AF, and interspersed are spoken word, found media, which means like Ronald Reagan's Evil Empire speech from 1983, a section of that is included in one of the songs. It's a wild listen. She and Issa Burke got together, did not realize they were making a record when they set up in the studio to record a couple of things and ended up doing a whole album. But she created these sonic landscapes of these traditional folk songs through the lens of all of the research that she had done about Satan over the past year. And that's what the album Each Machine is. And it got her thinking about moral panics, specifically starting with the satanic panic of the 1980s, which we do not explain what that is in this episode, by the way, if you'd like to seek elsewhere. And just moral panics that have happened through like modern human history and how those panics happen and what we can do as individuals to try to tamp down the panic. Okay, let me get into the introduction. I just spent so many hours researching for this interview. I hope that everything we talk about is clear. If you have any questions, I encourage you to either reach out to me or reach out to Carolyn. Carolyn Kendrick's latest project explores the complex themes of moral panic, tradition, and the figure of the devil, aka Satan, aka Lucifer. The LA-based songwriter opens up about the inspiration behind her album, Each Machine, which is accompanied by a thought-provoking zine that has four essays that Carolyn wrote about her experience doing this research. She discusses the significance of the color red in her work, symbolizing themes of anger, danger, and familial ties, and how it contrasts with the black and white imagery used throughout the project. Carolyn shares her unexpected journey into researching the devil, sparked by a podcast project that ended up overtaking her life, leading her to interview the leader of the Satanic Temple, among many others. This deep dive into the topic became a way for her to process the overwhelming political and cultural landscape. She candidly discusses the challenges of maintaining balance while being consumed by such a heavy subject matter. And spoiler alert, she did not maintain balance at all. The conversation also touches on Carolyn's work in podcasting with shows like You're Wrong About and You Are Good, and how it influenced her approach to music. She reflects on the importance of integrating culture and music, creating a world-building experience that connects various aspects of her life. Carolyn's creation of the Gender Equity Audio Workshop, along with co-producer and Each Machine collaborator Issa Burke, highlights the power of women supporting each other in the music industry, fostering an environment where questions can be asked without fear of judgment. She expanded on her exploration of traditional songs through a devilish lens, which allowed her to examine how their meanings shift when viewed in this context. She also discusses the dual versions of the hymn Are You Washed in the Blood, inspired by Naomi Klein's book Doppelganger, and how they represent different facets of her musical identity. Throughout the episode, Carolyn offers insights into forgiveness and harm, emphasizing the need for solution-focused actions in today's society. The episode concludes with a fun and quirky Satan-themed lightning round where Carolyn shares her favorite pop culture depictions of Satan and imagines a music festival in hell with much stipulation. Guys, The Devil is Fun Again with Carolyn Kendrick, the album Each Machine. We're going to actually listen to clips of the record throughout the interview. Sit back and enjoy. Don't be frightened. It's Carolyn Kendrick on Basic Folk. I wanted to start with a color that I found poppin' in your in your online presence these days. Yes. There is one color that stands out amongst the rest, and that is the color red.
Yes.
You use it on your latest album against a black backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like black and red is the theme. So what is your connection to the color red and the color scheme of red and black, and how did it suit this project?
You know, so this project is, like, as you may have picked up, like a bit of a departure from some of the other things that I've worked on in my life. And so much of the research that I've done and so much of the music that I've been interested in and so much of the music that ended up on the record is all about blood, for lack of a more nuanced term. Like, there's a song called Are You Washed in the Blood, and it's also, there's, you know, thematically, like, a lot of connection between, like, what are we compelled to do, both good and bad, for our families, for our communities, for our blood, metaphorically speaking, so to speak. And so I had been thinking that, like, you know, red is also the color of anger. Red is also the color of like danger, of warning signs. And so it just kind of made sense to me that like, and also, you know, a lot of this record is like what happens and the dangers of when you're thinking in black and white. And so, you know, that's also why all the photography is black and white. But then like the red is, I guess, just there to kind of contrast that.
Hmm. All right. Satan, prior to your work researching the devil and creating each machine, what was your experience with Satan?
I had so little experience with Satan other than just him or it, they being like a tertiary character in my life. Like I grew up around people who I loved very deeply, who are devout evangelists and devout like reactionary conservative Christians who think of the devil as being very literal in their lives. And so their lives and also how we would interact were very informed by the quote unquote devil. But it always felt like this very abstract thing to me because I was like, but he's not real. And so it was always this kind of push and pull between the people who I loved in my life who, you know, the devil was a very animating character for them. And therefore for everybody else, because they, you know, also incorporate that perspective into the people that they interact with. So it was like abstract for me, but very, very real for everybody else in my life. And so that's why I kind of wanted to get into it.
Mm, it's such a huge topic to like dive into. I think my mind just started racing as soon as I heard that you made a record after you did like so much research about the devil. Mm-hmm. What were your initial feelings when you were asked to do all this intense research about the devil?
You know, it was like it's like such a classic slippery slope situation where I signed up to be like a hired gun for this one particular project that is like still in process, but I have since left. But I like signed up and I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. Like I just knew that I was going to be helping with some research. I knew I was going to be doing some editing. I knew I was going to be doing some, you know, like helping out here and there. But then it was the kind of thing where as soon as I started like helping out with the research, I was like, wow, this is such a deep rabbit hole. And then like within a few months, I was like, oh my God, my entire life is like learning about the devil all of a sudden. So the making of this record was also me kind of contending with how intense of a process it became, like accidentally.
Yeah. When did you realize that it was like a lot larger than you thought it would be? And then like, how did you proceed? Like, how did you make sure you were like taking your care of yourself and proceeding with caution?
Well, I didn't was the thing. Like I didn't proceed with caution. And then I think the moment that I realized it was like a much bigger thing than I had signed up for was when I was interviewing the leader of the Satanic Temple, like in person. And we met like right after Halloween of last year. And it was one of those situations where I was like, wow, like I am a fiddle player and a songwriter. And like somehow all of a sudden my life has led to be where I'm like talking to the leader of the Satanic Temple about like repressed memory stuff. And it was like, what the heck? How did I get here? You know? But like I didn't really like take care of myself through the process because it became so like overwhelming and overtook me. I got like kind of obsessed, to be completely honest. And like I think like I needed a place to put all of my feelings, not just about the devil, but also it's like the devil, our political landscape, the dangers that we're in right now because of this conservative backlash, which is related to the satanic panic of the 1980s. And like, I think I like got fully obsessed with this because I was like, I need to think about this because like we're about to be wading into some very dangerous territory politically. And I don't really know what else to do, you know?
Just a quick left turn about the podcast work you've been doing. You have like been in this really cool orbit of some of the most compelling modern creators like Sarah Marshall from You're Wrong About and You Are Good, Chelsea Weber Smith from American Hysteria, Jamie Loftus, who has mm-hmm. done a bunch of serial podcasts, My Year in Mensa, which is my fave,
yes,
the ACT cast. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're kind of in these two really awesome worlds, the indie roots music world where you find mm-hmm. yourself in, and also like, I don't know if you call it like indie, nerdy, cool podcasting. So you, before working in podcasting, you kind of saw your music as being siloed. But now after working in podcasting, you see more connections. And now your thought is, what if I opened up music so that it was more of a world building experience?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to hear more about that. Like, how have you been able to expand yourself as an artist because of podcasting?
Well, I think with the work that I've been doing in podcasting, and also all of the amazing like journalists and creators that I've had the opportunity to work with, many of whom you just listed off, it's given me the opportunity to think of culture and music as being part of culture. I think I used to think of music as just being, you know, not necessarily connected to all of the other, you know, worries, values, concerns that existed in the outer world, and like was sort of separate from, you know, cultural criticism and learning about like the world at large. And now with seeing all of these incredible podcasters that I've had the opportunity to work with, and like, I've just kind of seen how like the work of the artist and all those people that I've learned from is to like weave together all of the parts of your life. And so I thought that this would be a good opportunity to like, you know, be authentic in the process of being like, well, working on podcasts is a big part of my life right now. Also music is the most important part of my life right now. So like, how do I weave these all together?
The title of the album is Each Machine, which comes from a Rilke poem. And from reading mm-hmm. about your experience researching the satanic panic of the 1980s, meditating on how it happened and how fear is a motivator in America, it seems like you've concluded that like the moral panics, or like each machine, mm-hmm. some examples being power, capitalism, patriarchy, each machine come out of the systems that we engage in.
Mm-hmm.
It probably took me 3 hours to write that sentence, by the way.
What's a great sentence.
Thank you. What can you say about the machines you see people engaging in today, 2025, and how best mm-hmm. not to allow them to turn into moral panic? Like, give us a step-by-step process.
Well, I think, yeah, I've thought about this a lot, and I think the main one that we're going to be kind of wading into this year is like, we all have different information that we interact with, right? So like the algorithm that I get on my feed is like very different than your algorithm, is very different than, you know, like my conservative family members, is very different from somebody who lives in rural Idaho, right? We all get different information, and the barriers for knowing if that information is like correct or factual, those barriers are down. And as we are moving into like a world of deep misinformation, which is, you know, even more serious than in the past years, even though it's been serious for a long time, I think like the very first thing that we can do, and kind of the only thing, is to go, okay, I just received some incendiary information. It's invoking an emotional response from me. It's invoking an emotional response from the people around me. What can I do, number one, to figure out if this information is factual? Can I find out the same information from multiple other vetted sources? And number two,
but once who are who are the vetted sources?
I think, like, you know, this is also the thing, is like, I mean, like, I would say places like NPR, I would say places that like have, you know, like journalistic integrity, like from the past, and like also thinking about like, okay, but then even that is like getting a little bit like slippery, because, you know, for example, like you also have to think about like, does this company that is like putting out information online, like, do they have a financial incentive to get you to feel any particular way? Mm-hmm. And like, that's often the motivator, is like, if I invoke an emotional response from this person, will they spend more money? Are they more likely to, you know, be politically useful to me in some way, shape, or form? And so, like, that, I think anybody, if you were to ask like any particular news outlet, everybody would have different answers for that. But like, if you can find outlets that have like historically had like good journalistic integrity, and you can find like the same information from multiple different outlets, I think that that is somewhat useful. Yeah, cross-referencing, and then also pausing before you take emotional action is probably even more important than, you know, being like quote unquote correct with the information that you have. And then also step three, at least like is the kind of the biggest step, is then thinking like, okay, if I am going to take action in this, who is going to be harmed in that, if at all, you know, like, mm-hmm. are my actions going to create a situation where other people will be in harm's way? And like, that was, you know, that's kind of the issue that was happening during the 1980s, is that like, the Satanic Panic happened, people were getting information from like, quote unquote, you know, neighbors and what they thought were verifiable sources, and like we're acting with the best of intention, but ultimately like a lot of people were falsely imprisoned, a lot of people used false a lot of false evidence was admitted, and a lot of people are like still in prison today for crimes they didn't commit.
Yikes.
So
the idea is to avoid harm.
Yeah, for me at least right now, that's like kind of my operating like guiding compass, is like we're like wading through a lot of misinformation right now. And like, mm-hmm. there are definitely steps to try to figure out like what's real and what's not real. But like the most important thing is like, how do we try to mitigate harm right now?
Do you hear the new master droning and throbbing? Its prophesying promoters are advancing.
Do you hear the new master droning and throbbing? Its prophesying promoters are advancing.
Do you hear the new master droning and throbbing? Its prophesying promoters are advancing.
No hearing's truly keen in all this noise.
Still, now each machine part wills its praise.
How it spins and wreaks revenge, deforms and demeans us.
See the machine. How it spins and wreaks revenge, deforms and demeans us.
See the machine, how it spins and wreaks revenge, deforms and demeans us. Since its power comes from us, let it do its work and serve serene.
This is a question about the spoken word and the, what did I call them? There's like found media on, mm-hmm. on this record.
Yeah.
One of them, an example of, is the title track, Each Machine, is from the Rilke mm-hmm. poem.
Yes.
Spoken word tracks, In the Beginning, Sugar and Spice. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a couple of pieces of found media in some songs, like Ronald Reagan's Evil Empire speech is featured in the song Are mm-hmm. You Washed? So it's really cool, Carolyn.
Whew. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And very stirring, like back of your hair on the back of your neck kind of feelings. Can you talk about your initial idea to include spoken word and found media, like what your hope in their inclusion would do to help express your thoughts and feelings about moral panics?
Yeah, I think my intention was to stir emotion rather than to have people come to conclusions with it. And I think that has been true thus far. From at least what I've heard from people. And I also just wanted to include them because I wanted people to have a little bit more context for what I was feeling when I was recording these songs. You know, like, and also so much of folk music is decontextualized these days. Like, you know, like a lot of these older songs, like people don't necessarily, or at least I'll speak for myself, like, you know, like I didn't necessarily grow up singing the song like Are You Washed in the Blood of the Lamb, but that's like a fairly traditional hymn that people have context for. And like I didn't grow up singing murder ballads, but a lot of people did. And so I wanted to include spoken word and found media to just give a little bit more texture and a little bit more Yeah, just like something to grab onto emotionally in between songs to say like, these songs come from our history. They are part of our history. We're in the middle of trying to decipher what we want our legacy to be moving forward. And music is part of history, just like we are, and as are our decisions. And so I just wanted it to be a little bit more like more of a place for people to have like moments of thinking about context in between the songs.
All my friends, believe me, the opportunity to get rich, to attain great wealth, is here now.
We know that living in this world means dealing with what philosophers would call the phenomenology of evil, or as theologians would put it, the doctrine of sin.
Never in the history of the world did a poor man without capital have the opportunities to get rich quickly and honestly as he does in our country today.
There is sin and evil in the world, and we're enjoined by Scripture and the Lord Jesus to oppose it with all our might. The glory of this land has been its capacity for transcending the moral evils of our past.
I say you ought to get rich, and it's your duty to get rich.
Here's a personal question. In the companion zine, you said, throughout the making of each machine, I have come to confront many of my own worst tendencies. Mm-hmm. One day around the crescendo of this work, that must have been a fucking day, I noticed my moral compass was far from pointing north anymore. And it actually was because you had not calibrated your true north.
Mm-hmm.
So what did it feel like to determine your personal north, like during and then after the process?
Yeah, like I think, you know, like what I had been feeling during that moment was like I kind of sacrificed like almost everything in my life to be devoted to learning about this project. And that's like, you know, like my romantic relationship were like I just was not investing time in them in the way that I, you know, normally would, and like my familial relationships were kind of tense, and I hadn't been spending time with my friends, I hadn't been like focusing on music, which is like a huge part of my, you know, my center. And I think it was just I realized, I was like, oh, I've like in lieu of balance and in lieu of like knowing who I am, I've kind of like sacrificed all of this just for the sake of this project. And I realized that, like, you know, it was kind of an expression of workaholism, and like also kind of an expression of my own vice, which is to like, you know, like hyper focus on one thing at the exclusion of the health of the rest of my life. And I also realized, I was like, oh yeah, that's like often what people are doing when they are being compelled by panic. Like they become hyper-focused on like one thing because it is something that is scary. And that's like kind of what I was doing.
Were you panicking? You were panicking.
I think I was, because like beforehand, I just didn't really have context for how much, I mean, I did like, but it didn't feel real. And as soon as I was learning people's names, as soon as I was learning about like the sentences that people were like still living out in prison, as soon as I learned about like the ways that people's lives had been destroyed, you know, not just in the 1980s, but like in the witch trials and in the blood libel panics, and also knowing that it's related to QAnon, knowing that we are still like in this like massive conspiracy culture today, I was kind of panicking. I was like, wait, what do I do with this? Like, how do you live in a world where everything is like uncertain all the time? And you know, like I'm kind of feeling a little bit like that today too, you know, because like I'm like currently staying at a La Quinta because like my house has been evacuated because like the fires are happening in LA today. And so yeah, like it was just this moment of panic. And like, you know, it's like, you know, that thing where you're like looking at yourself from outside of your body, but you're also inside of your body, and you're like, wow, I'm panicking, and I'm learning about them panicking. And also I realized that like the opportunity to make a project out of this and make some art about it was probably the way that I could bring myself back down mm-hmm. to like a level of understanding and feeling like I had some more tools to deal with it, actually.
Yeah, you said about creating this project, I needed a place to put all my feelings about moral panics. So there are many layers of this record. The more you listen, the more you discover. And if you read the zine, there's even more to learn and discover. Mm-hmm. Were you trying to make that part of the listening experience? Like, where did you see the listener? Where did you see the reader in this experience?
Yeah. Now that I'm like on the other side of releasing it, I have a little bit. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is like a lot for people to encounter for the first time. And like there's like definitely some capital T themes, and like maybe I could have cut down on themes a little, I guess. But yeah, I wanted it to be for the listener an experience of like, you know, being on like a
the Great American Road Trip.
Yes, I was going to say like being on like a theme park ride where you like enter and you're like, this is like the Hall of Horrors of America, and like here's all of these like you know, cornered. And, you know, my partner is like a very huge like horror fan, like horror movies. And I don't like watching horror movies. But because like we, you know, are together, like I am often around horror, which is like a great medium for expressing, you know, fear through metaphor. And so I think that's kind of why it's like so spooky, is because I was like, I think one of the great ways that we can utilize spookiness and metaphor is like, or speaking like one of the great ways that I can kind of like utilize this like genre is because it's like a good vehicle for metaphor. And so I wanted people to feel like they were kind of like going through a haunted house a little bit.
Whoa. All right. Recording the album, Issa Burke, everyone's mm-hmm. favorite. And
everyone's
one of your best friends, you both headed into Great North Sound in rural Maine to record. Mm-hmm. I've been to Great North Sound, which is Sam Kassir's spot in Parsons Field. The studio mm-hmm. is in like an old house in the country. So everything is like beautiful there, but it also has some spooky vibes.
Yes.
How did the surrounding of the studio help impact the vibe?
Oh, the vibes were like, I think that it's such a huge part of why the record ended up sounding this way is, you know, we recorded in November.
It Ugh, was everything's yeah, dead.
Everything is dead. Like there's like a very spook, you know, a very haunted cemetery like right around the corner that we would walk to during breaks. You know, the first night it was snowing, you know, the first snow of the year. And I think we really just like, Issa and I had so much fun because we just had the ability to just really try anything. That was kind of also part of why it was so great and the vibe ended up being so good, is because we could really do anything that we wanted and we had enough time and space to kind of try things out. But also it's like, yeah, you know, we're singing these old songs and we're like literally in this like house that's like creaking and you can hear the wind through the trees and all of that.
Bones are rattling in the attic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, also that must have just been so much fun. You guys must have been like laughing your asses off and freaking each other out the whole time.
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
My Lord said unto me, do you like my garden so fair? You may live in this garden if you keep the grasses green, and I'll return in the cool of the day. Now is the cool.
You and Issa started a project called Gender Equity Audio Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
Giao. This is where you host Studio Time for women who want to learn more about producing and engineering music. So this record mm-hmm. helped you and Issa both work on your own skills together. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to be able to record and learn with another female in the studio for this record? And like, what is powerful about women teaching women in a setting like the recording studio?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, Issa and I, yeah, I mean, we also just like have the comfort of knowing each other for such a long time. But after hosting the gender equity workshop, I really got to see in real time how important and powerful it is to have just space for us to be able to ask any question without fear of there having to be any dynamics of, you know, the men in the room like looking down on us because we don't know a certain thing yet, or like not having to prove yourself. And, you know, I just like, I have so many experiences over the course of my life as a musician. Like, I was just reflecting about, you know, like I was in bands in high school and like, it, you know, in these situations where I was like, I don't know why the microphone works like this. I don't understand why we use which cables. I don't understand like how the sound travels. But I also like can't really ask any of the people in the band this because like my ability to be here is already conditional. Like if I were to mess up in any way, like not musically necessarily, but like, you know, like I don't think they would say this, but like my presence was conditional. And so if I were to see him like I was kind of like a weak link in the chain, or if I was taking up too much time, or if I was asking too many questions or whatever, it would, I could see it being very easy to be like, well, you know, maybe not worth it. And there's been so many times in my life where I've like wanted to know something either about like live sound or producing or understanding like why, you know, why we use certain microphones, what's possible, you know, like how do we, and you know, like almost any musician will tell you like about how tense things can be when you like show up to a venue and there's like a sound person who you have like a weird communication style with, you know, often male. And so anyways, just like having the space to be able to be like, okay, no such thing as a dumb question. All of us have different, you know, comfort levels. And even if you've been doing this for years and years and years, there's still so much to learn. And even if you've never plugged in a microphone before, like today's your first day. That's amazing. That's great. I can't wait. Cause now you can like, not only does it like give you more ability to be flexible within your own work, it also, at least for me, like empowers me to be more confident when, you know, men in the studio or men on gigs or whatever, when they're saying like, no, you have to do it like this, I can be like, no, I don't. I can do it how I want it.
Then you say, because you know the devil so well, you can say, there are many ways to skin a cat.
That's, yes, that's true. Exactly. Exactly.
Which is something gross the devil would say. Okay. Drums, your first mm-hmm. instrument, even though you are not currently primarily a drummer.
Yes.
The drums, the percussion on this record, spooky as fuck. Mm,
yeah.
What is the rhythm of the devil like, and how did like rhythm play into this satanic project?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah. So I played some percussion on this, as did Issa. And the only person who we had do some overdubs is my friend Pelle Greenberg, who also did some overdubbed percussion on Leela. But I think, well, kind of regardless of the devil, I have been thinking about my relationship to rhythm lately, a lot. And I've also just been, you know, in this world where I'm thinking about how my relationship to music is like primarily a social relationship, but also a spiritual relationship. Like I am not, like I'm not religious, but like I do think that like my primary mode of relating with music is spiritual. And so therefore it's like very fun to think about how rhythm is like connected to both like the body and connected to the world, you know, like the world moves at a certain rate in the universe and we rotate around the sun at a certain rate, and like the celestial elements all have their own rhythm, and like our heartbeats have rhythm, and you know, like it's fun to think about it in that way. And then it's also fun to think about, like, when you're playing music with another person, and like in this example, like when I was playing music with Issa, like Issa and I have played music together and we've been in these like certain rhythms in our life, like for like a decade now. And when we play together in real time, it's like we're creating rhythm and space between these notes in a way that like will never happen again, but also has always kind of been happening within our relationship. And that might be like a really woo-woo answer that has like nothing to do with the devil, but I have been thinking about it a lot. And yeah, rhythm's cool.
A continuing conversation for us.
Yes. I think. Yes. Yes, definitely. Yeah. That's true.
I mean, who hit that timpani on Summer?
Me. Me. Yeah.
Give that timpani strike a Grammy.
Oh, holy good.
Yeah, Kim and I were like, she was telling me, she's like, Summer, I just listened to it over and over, that timpani.
I know. I'm so glad. Like, Summer is definitely one of the ones where I'm like, okay, this is, and like, I have no, like, illusions that this is like everyday easy listening for people. Like, it wasn't intended to be, but yeah, I'm so glad that people are into Summer, because when I learned about Summer from this movie called The Wicker Man, which is a, mm-hmm. like a horror film, like horror suspense thriller film from the late 60s, and they sing Summer Is a Coming In on that soundtrack, and I learned it there, and I was like, this is the creepiest song I've ever heard in my entire life, and it's from like the 12th century or something like that. Ooh. Like, it's so wild. I'm so glad that people are liking Summer.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, Kim's like, the devil's not in here, but then it is.
Yeah.
Sing with sad and blow with mad and sing the wood and new. Sing cuckoo. Sing with blood death after lum the after covet coo. Sing cuckoo.
So most of the songs on each machine, like the songs, the real, mm-hmm. the not the spoken yeah. word stuff, mm-hmm. They are traditional songs mm-hmm. that you've come across thanks to your many years of playing around the campfire. Mm-hmm. Let's see some examples. The Devil's Nine Questions, Are You Washed mm-hmm. in the Blood, Wind and Rain. You said, I've been thinking a lot about lineage and tradition lately. I've been thinking of all these songs that have these deep traditional roots. The songs that you chose, except for one I'm going to ask you about later, I can't find it and need your help. Mm-hmm. The songs mm-hmm. that you chose have a darkness in them. What did it look like when you started thinking about traditional songs in this manner, and how did the meanings of these songs start to change after you saw them through this devil lens?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, like, I've been in and around the bluegrass scene for like quite a long time at this point. And it's so funny because you'll hear these songs that are just like the darkest songs you've ever heard in your entire life, and like violent, scary lyrics, and that it'll be like this music that is like tonally like super bright and happy, and you know, like it's the banjo's rolling and it's not spooky at all, and there's like this interesting disconnect there where it's like, okay, at the heart of this music people are dealing with you know, like fear and awe and you know, like especially in these old gospel tunes, like of course you're going to be dealing with the devil, even if it's just about God, you know, like there's God is the devil is sort of always behind God's shoulder in those narratives. And so it was kind of fun actually to be like, okay, like I think I'm going to actually match these songs up like tonally with what the lyrics are like actually kind of conveying, instead of it being like sort of bright and sunny. So which, you know, they're not always like that, but you know, but often they are.
Yeah, so like that song Wind and Rain,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That seems like a very like bright and sunny song where it's like about a pair of sisters competing mm-hmm. for a man's attention. One of them gets mm-hmm. super jealous, throws the other in the river, and then this mm-hmm. like goofy fiddler comes along and turns this yeah. girl's body into a violin.
Right.
Like, what is your history with songs like that where, like, you're talking about it does have, like, a lovely melody and the lyrics are, like so messed up? Like, are you like a lyrics person where you're like, oh, this is fucked up? Or did the realization come later for you?
I've always been kind of a lyrics forward person. And yeah, I typically don't sing murder ballads like in jams. I don't like singing them. Usually because murder ballads can be sort of uncomfortably boring. Like it's often like, I'm a crappy guy and I got drunk and now I'm sad that I killed my girlfriend. But this particular one, Wind and Rain, which is also sometimes known as The Two Sisters, I thought that this one was really interesting, and it's kind of the only murder ballad that I sang, just because like I think it's worth contending with the history of murder ballads, and I think it's worth thinking about like, okay, this has been part of the tradition for a super long time. It's part of it now. What parts of it do we need to like acknowledge as we move forward into the future? And like this one, because like there's this element of like, you know, woman on woman crime that is like in the first half of the song, like that in and of itself is interesting. Like what does it mean when we are like killing our own sisters? What does it mean when we were like operating within patriarchy, but like as a woman, you know, like we often are like hurting
right
ourselves by hurting other
misogynistic women.
Right. Exactly. Which, you know, like that's just like definitely still part of our communities now and like part of our everyday life. And like, you know, like that's even a potentially a good example of that is like how many white women voted for Donald Trump, you know? And like the other thing is, but what's even more interesting to me about that song is like he uses her body to make his own art. And like that is also like, it's almost like a two-part story. You know what I mean? Where like that always got me thinking about like when we perpetrate harm against our own, like that's in and of itself like such an injustice. But then like the people who profit from that are like men, you know, like men will profit again and again and again from the violence that is done to women. And not just men and women, and like not just within the patriarchy, but like within any type of power, like any type of social power structure that happens, you know, people are profiting. And like in this song, it's like kind of silly because it's like he just makes a fiddle, but like he's a fiddler and then he has a fiddle at the end of the day from like the bones of this woman. Mm-hmm. And it just felt so indicative to me of like how power works in our country, where it's like those who are marginalized are harmed and hurt. And then the people who are in power or at least exempt from that harm then profit off of it. Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. Don't you dare.
Johnny gave the younger one a gay gold ring. Oh, the wind and rain. Didn't give the elder one anything. Crying, oh, the dreadful wind.
I have a couple questions about a few of these songs. So the Devil's Nine Questions. You ever listen to My Favorite Murder?
You know, it's been a long time, but I've heard a couple. Yeah.
That's my favorite podcast. I listen to it all the time. And there was like a joke that Karen, one of the hosts, made a joke that like nine is a power number. And yeah. I was like nodding along. I was like, yeah, because I like got my hair cut recently by this woman who was like, when's your birthday? And I told her, she's like, okay, so you're a five. So this is what this means. She's like, what's your wife's birthday? And she's like, oh, she's a nine. That's a powerful number.
Oh, wait.
And
I was like, Enneagram nine? Enneagram wise?
No, not Enneagram. She's just like a numerologist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
okay,
and she
cool.
cuts hair in South Portland if you're looking for.
Okay, that's actually. Wait, do you know who it is? I wonder if I know who it is.
Her name is Jennifer something.
Okay. Okay.
I have her
interesting.
Number. She's great.
I'm interested. I'm
enjoyed.
Interested.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so. And then I tried to like look it up before our conversation, but I couldn't find any intel about nine.
I actually have some intel about nine if you're interested.
Yes, please, please share.
Okay. So I have recently gotten very into tarot. And there is a great book about tarot by the filmmaker Jodorowsky. Might be pronounced Jodorowsky, I'm not sure. But he is like, he's a very problematic guy in certain ways. He was like a filmmaker in the late 60s and early 70s, but does have this book that is like very beautifully written about tarot and like the and like the symbology that happens within like the cards, but then also the numerology that has to do with it. And all of the nines in the decks are all of the themes have to do with crisis and new construction. So it's all about like the penultimate step of whatever you're going to be like of the end of a cycle. It's like, you know, because, you know, when you're thinking about 0 to 10, 0 is like everything in potential. 1 is the first step of that. And then 10 is like you're into this next cycle of being within the next decimal. So 9 is like you're on the precipice of like being into the next thing. It's all about like, it's all about like crisis, new construction, the last conflict before you resolve into the next step.
Whoa. Okay. All right. 9 questions.
And you'll be the devil's pawnee. What is whiter than milk? Sing 99 and 90.
What I really want to know, the song that I'm like, where's the devil in this song, is the song Leela.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is this the devil being playful and fun, that the world is just a game? Like, I cannot crack.
Oh, yeah.
I cannot crack this song.
I think that there is no devil in Leela is actually the answer to that. I wasn't thinking that there was devil in Leela. I was thinking of it as like Leela is, I actually was kind of in the track listing, I was thinking about putting Leela like second, actually like in like the 9th spot. I was thinking about it putting it like right before the very last song, but then I ended up changing it last minute and I have some regrets about it, but also not. But I think of Leela as being like, okay, when you've been going through, at least for me, as I was going through this journey, learning about the devil, like I'm not learning about the devil because like I inherently am like drawn to darkness. I'm learning about the devil and the satanic panic and all of these political themes because I want to know what my relationship is to light. I want to know what my relationship is to like everyday life. Like, how do I incorporate this going into what my actual values are, what my, you know, feelings are about like living in the light, so to speak. And not necessarily meaning like everything is good, but like, what does it mean for when you're not thinking about the devil, I guess. And so, so Leela felt like just like a good counter narrative to all of the other things that I had been thinking about, you know.
Basically, you're giving us a break.
I'm giving you a break, yes. And also giving myself a break. And also, like, philosophically, like, I very much, you know, connect with the lyrics of Leela. Like, I find myself feeling like that is a more representative account of what my actual philosophy on life is, rather than any of this, like, devil stuff.
Leela, Leela, this world is just a game.
I'm looking at the track listing, and track 9 is Sugar and Spice, which is the found media about abortion.
Yes.
Interesting, Carolyn. Okay, long setup for this question. Buckle up. You recorded 2 versions of the traditional 19th century hymn, Are You Washed in the Blood? The first version is Are You Washed?, which features a delicate arrangement that's juxtaposed with Ronald Reagan's 1983 Evil Empire speech and a sermon on prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
The song In the Blood is more rhythmic and ready for the campfire, like very like, oh, brother.
Mm-hmm.
And this decision to include 2 interpretations of one song was inspired by the book Doppelganger by Naomi Campbell, which investigates an online underworld of conspiracies and misinformation. And we talked about this a little bit, like in this song, you wanted to explore how we receive informations. What conclusions did you draw from recording these 2 versions of one song? Like, this is really cool. And a couple artists come to mind that you know, the band Trampled by Turtles.
Yes.
So they released Dave, the lead singer, he wrote five songs and he recorded them with Trampled by Turtles. And then he recorded them again with his side band. Anais Mitchell also has like one of her songs, Now You Know, which is on her XOA album where she like re-recorded a bunch of her songs. And it's also on her self-titled album. It's just like same song, different. Anyways, I was thinking about that. But for you, like what conclusions did you draw from recording these two versions of one song? Like is one version more for like a certain type of person than the other? Like how did it make you feel differently? And also, here's one thing that I was really digging into. Like how do you take into account someone's interpretation with where they are in their life or like even where they are in their day?
Yeah. I mean, I think the short and long is that like I wasn't really thinking about other people's experience when I was recording it. I was thinking about like my own experience and how like I live in this world where like I'm often recording these sort of like vibier, more indie rock things, you know, not just for myself, but for other projects and, you know, other people that I produce and stuff like that. But then I also have this whole very analog world, very acoustic world that is much more like what you would hear on In the Blood. And so for me, I was also thinking about how like I often encounter, you know, the same song and then like contextually where I'm playing it, it will feel different. I was also like going, you know, going through some like personal stuff where I was thinking about like, okay, I'm getting this information and how I'm responding to it when I'm in this context is different from how I respond to it in this context, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then also, you know, I had been reading this book, Doppelganger by Naomi Klein, which also just heads up, you said Campbell, not Klein. She's the supermodel.
Who?
Yeah.
It's where my brain is today.
Yeah.
Why did I say that?
Oh, that's okay. It's actually, she has a thing in the book about how that happens a lot to her as well, where like people just see Naomi and then they like say Campbell because she's like the most famous Naomi.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was also, just similar to what we were talking about, how like everybody, you know, gets similar fragments of information, but how it's presented differently, you know, like on your algorithm or like depending on which news sources you get, like you'll get vastly different conclusions depending on like who you are, where you live, like what your demographic is. And so it was less so that I wanted to have that I have like any conclusions about what that means, but I did want to have like a space to kind of explore what that felt like when I was, you know, like, okay, if I was going to do this particular song, how would it feel if I were doing it like with this one particular kind of Carolyn personality going on, and then what would it feel like if I was doing it with this other part of myself?
So cool.
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you fully trusting in His grace this hour? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?
Couple more questions and then a lightning round.
Okay.
You were talking about, I think this was on a Bay Area podcast. Harm done in society is because there is refusal to make amends, which lots of people think starts with admitting fault. It might be a false binary to assume admitting fault is a prerequisite to making amends. It's a lot there. what I took away from that is like wondering how this project and this realization changed your sense of forgiveness and forgiving.
It's always so wild to like hear something you said a while ago and completely forgot about, like read back to you. We're like, whoa, I said that. That's crazy.
Yeah. you said a lot of crazy things on that podcast. I couldn't believe it.
Oh God.
No, great. All good.
Okay.
And terrifying.
Yeah. I bet. Yeah. yeah. I think, you know, I was also going through some stuff in my personal life where, you know, like in my larger extended people that I'm close to were going through, you know, some addiction struggles. And I also, while in the middle of recording this album and like mixing it and everything, was really contending with like, what does harm look like And what does forgiveness look like when, like, the point is you can't really assign fault, you know, to anyone. And I was thinking about that within the context of addiction. And then I was also thinking about that in the context of, like, our society, because, like, who do you blame when we are in, you know, this particular, you know, conservative backlash right now? Like, obviously we can blame, like, the people who are causing harm and the people who are, like, overtly, you know, being aggressors right now. That's obvious. You know, like, you can blame Donald Trump and you can blame all his cronies and blah, blah, blah. And, like, that's justified. But then there's also this whole other group of, like, people who are in this gray area where they are still causing sincere harm, but, like, are never going to be able to know that that's what they're doing because they think they're operating with the best of intentions. And so, you know, I don't really have any leg to stand on like what other people should do, but at least within my own life, I am trying to do like a pretty serious accounting of looking at my life, taking people, like, first of all, like having space for in my personal relationships to be like, okay, let's like make sure that we have the opportunity to actually communicate with each other and say like, hey, what you did hurt me, or vice versa. Like, hey, you want to check in? Like, it seems like maybe we need to like actually talk about what's going on, and having like openness to be able to actually reckon with when harm is done. And without like actually like focusing on fault, because like that just, it just, I just don't necessarily think that that is what we can, what we should like, or what I should lead with at this point in time. Because like, if the point is to get to a place where harm is not necessarily like undone, but at least like acknowledged and then worked on, and like we can like make amends there, like that's what's more important to me at this point. And like, I'm trying to be like action focused and like solution focused, because I just think we're just getting to a point where we just like need to be solutions focused, because things are just kind of bad right now. And like, if we're, you know, pointing fingers, that's like actually kind of taking away from us getting our like our hands dirty and fixing things.
Like that one time I had my contractor on the phone and I was like, I'm not interested in figuring out how this happened. I'm
right. Yes.
In finding a solution.
Exactly. Exactly. That's that's why we're friends, Cindy.
Hell yeah. All right. How about Satan themed lightning round?
OK, here we go. Here we go.
In popular culture, who is your favorite Satan?
Who's my favorite Satan? That's a great question. I am going to say, in popular culture, this is like kind of a strange answer, but I am going to say the song Devil Town by Daniel Johnston, who is not necessarily a popular pop culture figure, but the song looms large in my life, and I have a Devil Town tattoo on my arm.
So, love that guy. Mine is Tim Curry in Legend. Thank you for asking. Yes.
That is such a great answer.
That's your second
great answer.
Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Carolyn, what is the devil's instrument?
I'm going to, I mean, the obvious answer is the fiddle. but also, depending on how sassy you're feeling, maybe his forked tongue, you know?
Oof, oof. What is the most evil number?
I'm going to say 7. 7 feels a little edgy to me.
2 syllables.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is Satan's favorite flower?
Satan's favorite flower, maybe like gladiolas.
What is Satan bringing to the potluck?
Oh, Satan is bringing... Oh, okay. He's bringing like mountain oyster stew, something weird.
Something that causes indigestion, most likely.
Yeah, and something that makes you go, what?
Okay, this is the last one. So the top billing, the 3 artists that are headlining the music festival in hell.
Okay. So there's, so in this question, in this world, there's hell exists, number one. Number two, in hell, there's a music festival happening. Number three, for listeners, I'm going to say, like, there's two interpretations of hell that we could go with. Number one is, like, cool hell, where, like, people are, like, you know, cool people hang out after death. And then there's, like, bad hell, where, like, actual awful people go, like Mussolini or whoever. He's, like, you know, smoking a joint with Steve Jobs. So there's, well, actually, I don't know if Steve Jobs is, like, that awful. I don't really know anything about Steve Jobs. I don't know why he came to mind. But so in that realm, I'm going to say, let's say, like, cool hell. Let's say cool. No, what am I doing?
Family-friendly hell.
Family-friendly hell. Let's see. Okay, the three artists who are playing the music festival at family-friendly hell. Mozart, maybe? Mm-hmm. I just found out that he maybe, I should learn more about this, but he maybe plagiarized some of his family members' work.
Oh, damn.
Mozart. Oh, God. I think I need to ask you one more question before
okay.
I go.
Wow,
into
this is more involved than I thought it would be. So you'd be like, sorry. Johnny Cash, Prince, and Tom Petty.
Okay, but it's like, is it like, are we talking like cool hell where it's like people? We're talking cool hell.
Well, we have to. All right. Like, the other thing is that we have to sell tickets.
We have to sell tickets. Okay, so this is like sexy cool hell. Not like where actual bad people go, right? Okay. So if we're thinking sexy, cool hell, yeah, I'm going to say, let's see. And we're selling tickets. Quincy Jones, RIP, maybe.
Okay.
He's going to sell some tickets.
Yeah.
Let's see. Who else? John Lennon? I don't know. I don't know why this is so hard for me right now. And then, I don't know. Let's see.
Would it be Robert Johnson? Because didn't he make a
yes.
deal with the devil? Yeah.
Thank you. Robert mm-hmm. Johnson. There Robert we go. Johnson. There we go.
Carolyn Kendrick, I really look forward to welcoming you back to speak about your non-Satan album, perhaps later this
Thank
year.
Thank you. I am also excited about that.
Thank you for coming on. I will see you in hell.
See you in hell, bud.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Look for us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can check out BasicFolk.com or listen wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, I suggest sharing it with a friend, like your best friend from high school who totally was goth and wore black lipstick and lots of black and introduced you to The Cure and Susie and the Banshees and the Bauhaus, and you went and saw Peter Murphy together at Harbor Lights in Boston when you were in high school and had a black confirmation dress. Send it to that person. They would definitely enjoy learning about Carolyn Kendrick's Each Machine. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. We love you so much. Talk to you next time. Bye.